So welcome to the people who are coming for the first time. How many are there? Look, just start. Yeah, good. Yeah. And welcome also to the people who are returning. This is the third class of a series of four on living the life, living the life of a spiritual renegade. And people who are just showing up, don't worry. We'll catch you up. No problem. And people who are continuing, there'll be a quiz on the stuff that we've already talked about. We'll be handing that out soon. The first class that we started this series with was, as Vaishali said, on getting motivated. Getting motivated to make a change in your life. One of the most important ways to get motivated to make a change in your life is to feel like you need to make a change in your life. If you don't feel like you need to make a change in your life, you'll never make a change in your life. So it's easier, in a way, for people to get started on a new kind of life if they recognize that the old kind of life hasn't worked out in the way that they had hoped. That a life of just greed, selfishness, materialism, acquisition, you know, just looking after number one, thinking about yourself and, you know, maybe a few loved ones and nobody else, isn't the way to be happy, isn't the way to bring true happiness. So this is what they call, you know, technically, in religious traditions, East and West, renunciation. And people hear that word renunciation, and they get nervous. And they say, uh-oh, I'm going to have to give up good stuff. You know, I'm going to have to give up having fun, or I'm not going to be allowed to buy anything anymore, and, you know, I won't be able to go to the movies or something like that. It doesn't mean that at all. Okay? So don't worry. When you hear the word renunciation, you should think renouncing suffering, renouncing unhappiness, renouncing unnecessary suffering. You know, there's necessary suffering and unnecessary suffering. Necessary suffering, rather than calling it suffering, we can just call it pain, okay? And, you know, pain is part of life. Psychic pain, psychological pain, physical pain, it's just part of life. And if someone tells you that, you know, that they can, that if you do X, Y, or Z, or, you know, if you recite such a mantra, or, you know, if you take this, you know, special pill or something like that, you'll never have pain again. You are being sold a bill of goods. You know, it's false advertising. Pain is part of life. Anybody got a physical body here? Do you think that having a body like this will ever, you know, prevent you from having pain? Physical pain. All of it. And the older you get, the more this is obvious. Anyone getting older here? I myself, for the last two mornings, I have woken up and I have a pain. I didn't do anything the day before, you know. Nobody tackled me. I didn't fall down. I just, you know, you sleep wrong or something. You know, your head goes like this instead of like this or something. And then you wake up and you can't move. You got a big pain here. And the spiritual life isn't to prevent you from getting neck pain for the rest of your life somehow. Or for getting a cold, flu, sickness, or from having any sort of psychological, you know, difficulties, sadness, you know, like that. Pain is part of life. If there weren't pain, there wouldn't be pleasure. Okay? Because there is pain, we can know what pleasure is. Because it's the opposite of pain. these things that go together in the Eastern traditions, especially, they talk about this as duality. There's dualities in the world, up, down, black, white. There would be no up unless there is a down, right? Up is in relation to down. There's no black without white. There's no present without past. There's no past without present and future. There's no future without past and present. Did I get them all? Yeah. Everything is in relation to each other, right? In relationship to each other. And pain is part of life, okay? But there's a difference between pain and suffering. It's an important difference. Pain is part of life. Suffering need not be part of life. Suffering is optional. And so, you know, as a kind of a first step in one's serious spiritual life, in making a serious kind of change in your life. So I don't want to unnecessarily suffer. Okay? I realize that pain is part of life, that, you know, it's unrealistic, it's a fantasy to think that I'll never have pain again. But I need not make myself suffer over and over and over again. We are in charge of that. We are not in charge of pain, okay? But we are in charge of suffering. And very important to make a difference, to draw that difference between pain and suffering. So the first step is to say, I do not want to go through life unnecessarily suffering. Life is going by quickly. You know, every day that we live is one less that we have to live. And we are suffering. This is the first thing that the Buddha said. First thing that the Buddha said as he achieved his awakening, his enlightenment, when he came back and he started to teach. This is the first thing out of his mouth. He said, you guys are all suffering, you know. And that wasn't the end, fortunately, of what he said, okay? He didn't say, you guys are all suffering, gotta go, good luck. The second thing he said, and suffering is caused. We'll go into this more at the Buddhist Library on Saturday night, Four Noble Truths. Suffering is caused. And he didn't add a little footnote there, or amendment. And it's caused by the irritating person at work. He didn't say, and it's caused by anything other than decisions that you have made. Your suffering is caused by decisions that you have made. And so it is unnecessary. It's unnecessary if you stop making the decisions that bring suffering, you can end suffering. Okay? Maybe not pain. I would say pretty much 100% not pain. You know. But pain need not be suffering. Here's an example of how you can have pain and not suffer. Okay? Childbirth. Is childbirth painful? But it need not be regarded as suffering. You see? There's kind of like, you know, endurable pain and pain that isn't endurable because it is suffering. You see what I mean? Yeah. The pain that you go through in childbirth, I've never gone through it myself, but I've been with women who've gone through it, and it's obviously painful. You know, they're screaming, they're yelling, you know, blood's everywhere. It's a train wreck. But then, maybe some men here will relate to this. You know, after this hours and hours and hours of seeming torture, you know, pain, extreme pain, you know, the baby comes and all those things. And like within a couple of weeks, it's like, maybe we should have another one. And you go, what? You just went through all that, you know. You see, so that's difference, right? So it wasn't suffering. It was pain, all right. But it wasn't suffering. So the first step is to say, I am tired of unnecessarily suffering. And that's renunciation. Getting that kind of renunciation. And I think there are two ways that happens in most people's lives. You can bottom out or top out. Bottom out or top out. Bottom out means like, you know, for those people who were at the Bhagavad Gita class on, when was that, Monday? you know, you run into a brick wall in life. You have a major disaster. You realize that, you know, you weren't really in control of things ever, because all of a sudden, you know, something completely unexpected and unwanted happens. And you have no resources for dealing with it. You know, no inner resources for dealing with it. And that's a very powerful wake-up call to say, like, look, I got to develop some inner resources, you know, before the next one hits. Because we are in one of two positions in life, always. We are in a disaster, or we're between a disaster. Okay? We are in a disaster, and people who are in a disaster, I don't need to tell you about it at all, because you know. Okay? You know. You know what it feels like to have the rug pulled out from underneath you. All of a sudden, your health is gone. All of a sudden, your loved one's not there anymore. All of a sudden, you have your career tanks. You know, suddenly the boss tells you, you know, go home. You know, you don't have a job here anymore. You know, suddenly, all of a sudden, things can change dramatically. And no one is immune from that possibility, okay? No one. No one has any kind of guarantees that that kind of thing only happens to other people. So I'll tell you a quick little story on that. Some of you may have heard this before. That's all right. This was brought home to me early on in my adult life when I lost my best friend. My best friend, one day, out of the blue, to all of us, got into his car and ran it into a telephone pole at 90 miles an hour and killed himself. And just like that, gone. Yeah. And so I remember having a dinner with his widow. She was 40, you know. She lost her husband at 40. She was expecting to spend her whole life with him, yeah? Grow old together and all like that. And all of a sudden, he's gone, just like that. She didn't know it was coming. I didn't know, you know, friends didn't know it was coming. She didn't know it was coming, just suddenly. So we had a dinner together, and, you know, and we were talking about John's death. And, you know, I said, like, well, you know, in the wake of this tragedy, in the wake of this disaster, you know, I've gotten a little bit more serious about a spiritual life, my spiritual life, because, you know, I realized I didn't have very many resources to deal with this sudden, you know, change of events. And she said, well, what is your spiritual life? And I said, well, I'm trying to learn a little bit more about Buddhism, trying to practice a little bit more about Buddhism. And she said, well, what does Buddhism teach? And I said, well, you know, the first thing that Buddhism teaches, the first teaching of the Buddha was supposed to be that life is suffering, that there's suffering in life. And, you know, she just looked at me across the table and goes, is that controversial to anyone? You know, she was in the middle of a disaster. She knew that life was suffering, you know. She knew that life was painful. And so there's that, you know, people who are in the middle of a disaster. This can be a very, if you are in the middle, and, you know, chances are, you know, a certain percentage of people in this room are in the middle of a disaster right now. And never let a good disaster go to waste. You can learn a great deal from a disaster about, you know, about life, about what you can and can't control in life. You can't control the events of life. You can't control, you know, friends deciding to run their cars 90 miles an hour into a telephone pole. You can't control your own health, really. You see? Can't control your body. Can't control events. What you can control is your responses. What you can control is your response to uncontrollable events. But if you haven't disciplined yourself, if you haven't learned how to do that, if you haven't started a spiritual training, then you have no resources to do anything except for just be, you know, battered about by life. So that's bottoming out. And then there's topping out. And I had experiences of this too. You know, when I set out in my adult life, I set out to have, you know, like everyone else pretty much, to have a family, to have children, to have a good job, to have, you know, have enough money, to live in a nice place. And by the age of about 45, I had all of those things. I was a professor. My chosen profession was a professor. And in the academic world, there are various ranks that you go through. You start as an instructor, and then they make you an assistant professor, an associate professor, and a full professor. And I had done all that. By the time I was, in my mid-40s, I had achieved everything I set out to achieve professionally. I had my family. I had an apartment, on the beach, with ocean view, with two surfboards sitting out on the porch where I could surf every day. I had a motorcycle. I had it all wired up in the mid-40s. Kind of hit the top in what I had wanted to do in life. And, so I'm thinking, well, so now what? Now what do I do? I'm 45. Well, hopefully I'll live to, 78. Hopefully, who knows? But what am I going to do for the rest of these, kind of a midlife crisis, right? They call it a midlife crisis. And so that's the top-out thing. It's like, well, where's the happiness I was looking for if it isn't in the things that I thought it was going to be in? It wasn't unpleasant. I wasn't saying like, this beachside apartment sucks or something like that. It didn't suck. It was nice. I had tenured position. They couldn't fire me. I had lifetime security, job security. Had more money than I knew what to do with, really. I had fairly modest, wants and needs. So, I had all kinds of excess money. And I still wasn't content. We were talking about happiness last night as contentment, right? And so that's the top-out scenario. There's only one thing worse than not getting what you want. And that's getting it. And then, so you get what you want, what you thought you wanted, right? You get a good job, you get a nice, apartment, get a nice location, you get a nice savings account, et cetera. And then you go, well, this hasn't brought the satisfaction that I thought it would bring. So we'll talk a little bit more about that tonight, about the way that we have been putting all our eggs in the wrong baskets, okay? Like money, like possessions, like, relationships and so forth. It's important to have money, okay? Nobody's going to, hear tonight that it's better not to have money than to have money. It's better to have money than to not have money, okay? For sure. Anybody who's unclear on that hasn't had to be poor ever. Being poor and not being able to pay your debts and stuff, and worrying about money all the time is not the solution either. Yeah? Better to have money than to not have money. But to think, for example, that money will bring you the happiness that you're looking for is a fool's game. So we'll talk more about that kind of thing. Right? Topping out. In a way you could say pretty much everyone in this room has topped out, when it comes to, global comparisons. The kind of lifestyle that, we all live is top of the line, top shelf, first class, compared to how most people around the world live, right? So in a sense you could say everyone in this room has topped out. So bottom out or top out, one or the other, if you're paying attention, if you're interested in your life and realize that it's finite, it's not going to go on forever, and you're tired of being dissatisfied all the time, then you might be willing to make a change. You might be saying, well, what could I do that would bring the kind of contentment that I'm really looking for? And then you get serious about the options. So again, I'll just tell you a little story about my options. When I had the, midlife crisis maybe. So I thought, well, maybe I should change careers, I was a professor. I didn't mind being a professor. It was actually a very easy job. Are there professors here? I won't tell too much about how easy a job it is. No, if you've been a professor for a while, you've got all your lecture notes already done, okay? You got big files, and you just pull the file for your lecture notes, and you say the same thing that you said like every other year. You go and teach two or three times a week. Sometimes they make you go to faculty meetings, but usually you could figure out some way to skip those. you get, at least in the American system and systems that are based on it, you get about 4 or 5 months off a year, paid. Yeah, you know, because the academic terms end and there's holidays and there's summer holidays and, you know, pretty cushy, okay? So it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like a bad job. But I thought, well, you know, I'm dissatisfied. Maybe I should try something else. And so I was scanning around in my own mind, like, well, what would be cool? What would be interesting? And I hit upon something. I think I'll be a bush pilot. A pilot, you know, that flies a private plane and takes hunters and fishermen and things like that into, like, really remote places. It sounded like a very, very cool job to me, very exotic job, right? You know, I even knew where I was going to do it. I was going to, like, locate myself in Alaska as a bush pilot and take you know, sportsmen in my bush plane to Siberia. There is a job like that somewhere. Somebody's doing that right now. Okay, and they pay you a lot of money to do it, and you land in Siberia, and they go fishing, and, you know, for a week, and then you fly back and relax with all your money. So I started taking flying lessons. You know, and flying is really fun. It's really fun, and they hook you right away. You get into the plane. First of all, you pay money, okay, for flying lessons. I'll get back to that in a second. But they get you in the plane, and then the pilot, the instructor, actually takes the plane off. He takes off. He does the takeoff part because that's hard. And you could die pretty easily, you know, if you don't know what you're doing taking off. Taking off and landing, the instructor does. But then once you're up in the air, first lesson, he's like, okay, now you fly. And you go, really? He says, yeah, no, you've got the controls now. I do? And they let you fly. Well, you know, because there's nothing else to hit or anything like that. You just, like, fly around. You know, I'm flying. So, you know, this is it. This is all, you know, and I had the whole visions of, like, flying, you know, in bush pilot, flying in Alaska and Siberia and all like that. Well, it turns out that renting an airplane and an instructor 20 years ago now, was about $150, $200 a pop. It's probably more than that now. And so it was very expensive. This was for like an hour, you know, 45 minutes an hour. And then it turns out that in order to get a license of any sort, let alone a bush pilot license, takes hours and hours and hours and hours, okay? And I started doing the math about what it was going to cost me to, you know, even come close to getting the, you know, pilot's license that I wanted. You know, they give you, like, little pilot's license before that. You can only fly in the daytime. And then you give them another license that you can use the equipment so you can fly at night. And all. Thousands and thousands of hours and, you know, and tens and maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars. Most people become pilots. Most of the pilots, you know, who are flying anywhere, you know how they got their license? How they got pilot's license? Take a guess. In the Air Force. They joined the Army or the Air Force. They joined the military where they got it free. All you need to do is give them like 5 years of your life. And then, you know, they train you how to fly a plane. So that didn't work out. So then I thought, well, maybe I'll just be a surfer. You know, surfing, I was very fond of surfing, and surfing's a lot of fun. Anybody who's done surfing will know surfing's a lot of fun, very addictive also, but very, very hard on the body, especially for a, you know, middle-aged man who's getting older. And, you know, took a lot of ibuprofen in those days. And it's like, well, this isn't working out. So, you know, you try things, right? You try alternatives, and this is important in life. It's important in life to try out what you think will make you happy. And sooner rather than later. Don't defer it, you know. This is the advice that I give young people, especially, is, you know, if you think that being a bush pilot is going to make you happy, go for it. Try to be a bush pilot, you know. If you think jumping out of airplanes is going to make you happy, go jump out of an airplane already. If you think, you're going to be happy, if only I could go to the Philippines, I'd be happy. Oh, I got to go to the Philippines. And you spend your whole life, thinking that if only you got to the Philippines, you'd be happy. Get to the Philippines already. Go. It's not that hard. Sell some stuff and get a ticket and go to the Philippines, And you'll find, as you explore these things, that, that they're pleasant enough. They have their ups, they have their benefits, but there are downsides too, Spend all this time thinking about going to the Philippines. You get to the Philippines and you don't like the food. You find out that the food is crappy or something. You know what I mean? And then you get it out of your system a little bit. And then you say, well, now what really is going to work when it comes to satisfaction, when it comes to contentment in life? And then you get going, okay? So last night we were talking about one very, very important component of what it means to get going in a spiritual life. What it means to start a spiritual life, and that is to rehabilitate your past. To learn how to think about your past in a healthy-minded way rather than in a way that's just tormenting you all the time. Because that's unnecessary suffering. See? So the beginning of renunciation means I want to stop unnecessary suffering. How do I do that? Well, for one thing, you can stop holding the burning coal that's burning your hand, that's causing you pain, which is the resentments and anger and bitterness about the past. See, that's only you. Only you are holding on to that. The past is gone. Okay, right? That's what we talked about last night, in a way, right? Past is gone. Past means past, right? Past means it's happened already. So where is the past? The past is only a part of our present mind. The past is what we would call memories. Do memories change or not? Yes or no? Yes. Do memories change? Over time, do your memories change? Yeah, of course they do, right? So because memories change, memories are changeable. Because they change, they are changeable. We can change our memories. You can't, just make up new stuff about what happened in your life, okay? But you can change your understanding of what happened. You can change your interpretation of your past and thereby stop suffering so much unnecessarily. It is unnecessary to suffer about your past, about feeling like a victim, feeling like being abused and so forth. This is just a story that you're telling yourself about the past. Everyone has gone through trauma in the past, okay? Everyone. And your trauma is not obviously and objectively more traumatic than anyone else's trauma. Trauma is not an objective thing, it's a subjective thing. It's a subjective thing. So this is everyone's tendency, I think, that at least some part of everyone's tendency is to think, well, my situation is unique. I've been hurt, I've been, abused, I've had problems that other people just haven't had. And so my suffering is sort of, my suffering makes me special. We use our past suffering to think of ourselves as special and unique. Everyone has suffered in the past. You are not unique in the fact that you have suffered, okay? And there's no objective gauge as to who suffered more. You can't say, I've suffered 6.7, and you've only suffered 3.3. It's not objective. It's subjective. I'll tell you a quick little story about this. It's a story I heard related. Do you all know what a sorority is? A sorority is is like a club at the university, women's club, where girls who are going to the university join the club, the sorority. So there's a story about this girl whose mother and grandmother were members of the same sorority at the same university. And that being a member of that club, of that sorority, was sort of defining of their whole lives, grandma and mom. It was a big, It was not just a big thing for the time that they were in university, but they became supporters of the sorority after, you know, growing up. They would come back for all the reunions, etc. It's like a big deal for them, right? So this girl was brought up thinking, you know, this is the really crucial thing about, you know, being in this family. Being a woman in this family is joining this sorority. So she applies to the, you know, the school that has the sorority. She gets in. She gets into the uni. But then you also have to apply to get into the sorority. The sorority that had been so important, you know, to her grandmother and her mother, and had been instilled in her that this was, you know, kind of crucial that, you know, she carry on the maternal tradition and get into the sorority. So she applies to the sorority, and guess what happens? She doesn't get in. They turn her down. And her life is ruined. She, you know, she's traumatized by it. So a little thought experiment. You know, so some of us in the room, myself included, might say, not getting into a sorority is no big deal, okay? Compared to, like, some of the stuff that can happen to you in life, not getting into a sorority is no big deal. But from her point of view, you see, from the subjective point of view, it was life-shattering, shattering. See? So suffering is subjective, and your suffering, as with everyone else's, you know, it is not special. We are all in the same boat when it comes to suffering, and it's the Titanic. we're all suffering. You see, I told you the story about the Buddha trying to, you know, telling the woman to go find a mustard seed in the kitchen of a family that hasn't had a disaster. We've all had disasters, okay? And so, but carrying them on, you know, reliving them over and over and over again is unnecessary. We don't need to be doing it. We don't need to be reviving that Frankenstein monster over and over and over again. We can start telling ourselves a different story about our past, and thereby make a major step in reducing unnecessary suffering. It's the past is in our hands. Our understanding of our past is totally in our hands. Not a victim of it. Okay? So how do you do it? How do you tell yourself a better story about the past? People were here last night. Quick, two things. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, G. Forgiveness and gratitude. Forgiveness means you forgive the people that hurt you. You forgive the people that you're angry with, that you're bitter about. You forgive them. And you let it go, like letting a burning coal go from your hand. And you say, oh no, I'm only hurting myself by not forgiving. I am not hurting anyone else. No one else is suffering except for me. See? Auto-suffering. A-U-T-O. Auto-suffering, just causing myself some more suffering by not letting the burning coal go. And just say, okay, it happened, it was painful, it wasn't pleasant. You don't have to, like, be in denial about the fact that, you know, you had traumas. Of course you had the trauma. And of course people were nasty to you, you know, at least from your point of view. You were hurt. You don't deny it, but you say, I'm not going to keep reliving that Frankenstein monster over and over and over again, revitalizing it, reinvigorating it by thinking about holding on to those memories, that kind of memory. So you say, I forgive you. And you gift yourself with a different understanding about your past. That's the first step. Okay? And that's totally in our hands. Anyone can do it at any time. Okay? In real life, actually, it takes some time to do that because we are so used to holding on to the coal, and our grip on it is very strong. You see, partly because we've defined ourselves through that trauma. We said, I am the kind of person who has had X, Y, or Z, you know, suffering. So it's hard to redefine yourself. You know, to think of yourself differently. But if you're motivated enough to want to be a happy person instead of a sad person, a person who's on their way to satisfaction and contentment in life instead of wasting minutes, hours, days, weeks, months, years of this precious life embittered, unhappy, then you'll be, you know, at least, you know, on your way to be willing to do the hard thing. We talked about it last night. It's hard to forgive. It's not easy. But it is in your self-interest to do so. Can't be happy and holding a grudge at the same time. If you want to be happy, you've got to let it go. And then, as a second step, G, to be grateful. To be grateful for your life, for everything about your life, for all the people in your life, for all the experiences in your life, for the obviously, you know, kind of beneficial experiences that you've had in relationships that you've had with your parents, with your friends, with your teachers, etc., but also with the difficult ones, with the people that were difficult, and be thankful to them also, and, you know, for all kinds of reasons. They helped you become the person that you are. They helped you become the person that you are. And since you've already been practicing forgiveness, you can also say, they made it possible for me to practice a virtue like forgiveness because they hurt me. How else could I practice a virtue like forgiveness unless there was someone that I needed to forgive? Thank you. Okay? And then you change your past. You radically change your understanding of the past, and immediately you will change what? Your present. Because the past is only part of the present mind. So if you want to be happier here and now, you know, in your present life, start working on changing the kinds of memories that you're holding on to. And that's totally possible. You can change the past. So tonight we'll talk about controlling the future. Controlling the future. And then tomorrow night we'll end up by a kind of a survey on how to remain happy in the ongoing present. So yesterday was past, today is future, tomorrow will be present. And that's all the time there is, actually. So if we get all three of them covered, then we're happy all the time. We're happy about all the time. We're happy about all the time. Because the past is only a part of the present mind. Now let's talk about the future. Does the future exist or not exist? What do you think? Did the same thing with the past last night, right? Does the past exist or not exist? You could say, no, it doesn't exist anymore. It's gone, right? Past doesn't exist. But you can also say, yeah, no, the past does exist. But how does it exist? How does it exist? Where does it exist? When does it exist? It exists as part of our present, as part of our ongoing present mind. That's where the past is. So let's do with the future. Does the future exist or not exist? Future hasn't come yet. How can it exist? It's not here. So you could say, no, it doesn't exist at all. The future doesn't. You could say the future doesn't exist. It does exist where? In our present mind as expectation, isn't it? The future, you could say, is what we would call expectation, what we think will happen in the future. Okay, that's the only future that exists. And when the future does exist, it isn't the future anymore, if you see what I mean. Because what is it? Then it's the present. Okay? So until the future becomes the present, the future only exists as expectation of the future in our present mind. What we think will happen. Everyone okay with this? Better nod some more, or else I'll have to like say this again about 6 or 7 times. The future exists only as part of the present mind, of what we anticipate or expect or think might happen. Okay? Right? Okay, good. Now, if we were thinking, so you could say the future is imaginary, right? It's about your imagination. It's imagining what might happen, right? So it would be one thing if when we were imagining the future, we were imagining nothing but cool stuff happening. Oh, I can hardly wait for next week. And the holidays are coming. Oh, it's going to be so wonderful. And after that, I'll go back to work And that'll be so great to go back to work after, you know, if we were imagining that kind of a future, well, you know, it would still be imagination. It would still be dreaming in a way. You know, think, but it would be a good dream. Yeah? It would be a nice hallucination. But how often is that the way we think about the future, when we're thinking about the future? I think if you're like most people, when you think about the future, you're not thinking about how awesome the future is going to be, but you're worrying about it. You're thinking about all the things that could go wrong. This is basically what stress is, of course. Stress is thinking about all the stuff that, you know, could happen, might happen, and getting yourself all worked up about it in the present, right? Ruining your present by dreaming nightmarishly about all the things that could go wrong in the future. Yes or no? So it's, you know, instead of having a good LSD trip, you know, hallucination, you go on a bummer when you think about the future. You know, worrying, you know, just thinking about all the stuff that could, might happen that you don't want to happen, isn't it? So the next part of the spiritual life, next part of, you know, the progress here, the unfolding of how to live a life happily, is to stop worrying about the future. Wouldn't that be nice? Stop being tormented by the past and stop worrying about the future. So how do we do that? And so that's tonight's class. How to stop worrying about the future. So in your handout here, you have excerpts from the reading. And like I've said in the last couple of nights, I'm not going to go through them, you know, word by word, paragraph by paragraph. I'll summarize them, and then you can, you know, take it home and try to remember what it was that we summarized as you're reading the thing. But in the first part of the reading, the future is now, that sort of goes through what I just summarized. Yeah? That the future is now. That the future is, the only future that really exists is our anticipation, our expectation, our dreaming about what kind of a future we will have. Okay? The future is now. Just like the past is now. Okay? The past is now in the sense of it's being part of our present mind, memories and stuff like that. The future is only now too, in the form of what we expect to happen in the future. So tonight we'll talk about the fact, number one, that the future is in our hands. I kind of skipped to the last paragraph of Roman numeral number one there. The future, like the past, is in our hands. We don't have to feel like we're either victims of an unalterable history or slaves to an uncontrollable future. And so before we go on, I think it's important to talk a little bit about what we can control and what we can't control when it comes to the future. You can't control the events of the future. Okay? I mean, you know, humankind has been trying to figure out a way to do this for a long, long time. You know, soothsaying and prophesying and, you know, magic and all kinds of stuff. Trying to figure out a way to control the future in that sense. Control the events in the future. And we're trying to do it in all kinds of ways too, in ways that I'll talk about in a minute. In our ordinary lives, we're trying to do all kinds of things to gain security, you see, over the events of the future. And you can't do it, okay? Let's be realistic here. We're all grown-ups, okay? You can't control the events of the future. Have you noticed things unexpected happen all the time? Right? That's called life in a way. Yeah? So we try to control the future. We think we want to control the future. It is, number one, impossible, and number two, undesirable to control the events of the future. It's impossible and undesirable. So since it's impossible, it doesn't matter if it's desirable or undesirable in a way, because it's impossible. But think about what life would be like if you actually could control the events of the future. See, it's impossible, so you don't have to think about it too long. But, you know, what kind of a life would it be where nothing unexpected ever happened? And I'll give you one word for it. Boring. You see? No, it's the joy of living is in the surprises, isn't it? So why do we even want to control the future at that level, you see? In terms of the events of the future, we would, if we could do it, we would be very, very disappointed. If we could do it. Fortunately, we can't do it. You don't have to worry. But even if we could do it, it would be boring, you know? You would know exactly what was going to happen every time, right? Every time it happened, you go, yeah, I knew that was going to happen. I've controlled the future. I knew that was going to happen. Every time somebody said something to you, you go, yeah, I knew exactly what you were going to say. You know, every time you met a new person, you say, yeah, I knew I was going to meet you. So what kind of a life would that be? I don't know if you have these in Singapore at Sentosa Island or something like that, but there are many water parks around the world that have what they call wave machines. You know what a wave machine is? Where they make waves and you play in the waves. And the machine part of the wave machine is that every wave is exactly the same. Right? And this is kind of like what we, when we're not thinking about it, when we're thinking about the future, think we want. We want nothing unexpected to come. We just want the wave machine, over and over. Same old boring wave coming in, over and over and over again. The fun part about playing in the waves, if you actually have done this in the ocean, where there are waves, you've got to get out of Singapore and find this. Go to Indo or something like that. Is that every wave is different. Every wave is unique. So, you know, if you spend any time surfing or bodyboarding or something like that, you know, this is the excitement of playing in waves, is that they're unpredictable. You never know which one's going to come next, how big it's going to be, what the shape is going to be. It's unpredictable. That's the fun of it, you see. So in our, like, dream of controlling the future, we have this idea that it should be like a wave machine, so that nothing unexpected, nothing unanticipated, nothing unwanted ever happens. First of all, it's impossible. Second of all, it would be boring as hell. Okay? So the boring as hell part is not nearly as important as it's impossible. Just give it up, you see. Life is not a wave machine. Life is like the ocean. And every wave is different. And you can't control that. Okay, so that's what you can't control. You can't control events. You can't control other people. Have you noticed that yet? You know, this one, now we're getting a little harder. I mean, most of us recognize that we can't control events. Although we try some, you know. Like, but then it comes to other people, that we knock our head against that wall over and over and over again. You know, trying to change people, trying to make people, you know, do what we want them to do, try to be who we want them to be, and so forth. Can't do it. Can't control what people do, you can't, other people, and you can't control what other people say. Isn't it? Yes or no? All right? And so you can give up that as a dream. Of being able to control. I mean, not just one person. You know, sometimes we think, well, at least I can control my husband. You know. But then you go to work and there's all these other people that you can't control at all. Or you're just walking down the street of Singapore and there's like all kinds of out of control people all over the place, you know. Doing stuff, you know, saying stuff, getting in your way, bumping you. You know, can't control other people. And second of all, you know, it's the same with the events, okay. You wouldn't really want to. If you could, you really wouldn't want to. Again, there would be no interesting things about other people if you knew, if you could control what they do or say. Nothing interesting would ever happen in your relationships. So you can't control events of the future, and you can't control people, you know, in the present or the future, for that matter. Okay? So how do you control the future? In what sense can you control the future? It's the same kind of exercise that we did with the past, okay? You can't just change what happened to you in the past. You know, you can't change where you were born. You can't change the data of your life. But you can change your understanding of it. And similarly with the future, okay? You can change your responses to the unexpected. And you can learn how to control that. You can't control the waves, okay? You can't control what wave is going to come next. But you can learn how to surf each and every one of them, no matter what shape they have. Okay? Can't control the waves, no wave machine in life. But you can learn to negotiate them properly, happily, skillfully, in a way that maintains your basic sense of happiness. Okay? No matter what happens. So that's the goal here. See, that's really the goal. So tonight we'll talk about how to get to that goal. And the way you get to that goal is by training yourself now in the present. Okay? Training yourself now in the present. It's like going to surf school. You got to go to surf school now if you're going to be able to surf the waves in the future when you go out, paddle out in the ocean. You got to know how to negotiate the waves. You know, have to have the skill set. So before we go into that, I'll just quickly review number two here. I call this the big five. We are actually trying to control the future. We do try to control the future, not just through, you know, magic and soothsaying and prophesying and tarot cards and stuff like that. I had an experience recently in Hong Kong last May when I was there. And some guy, an Indian guy, came up to me on the streets of Hong Kong, as they will in India regularly. And, you know, start doing this whole thing about, like, you want me to read your future, you know? They guess a little something about you, and you go, oh, yeah, that's right. Would you like to find out more? And, of course, it costs you money. And the guy was very taken aback when I told him, I don't want to know about my future. I'm probably the first customer he had who said, I don't want to know. Why would I? You see? First of all, you can't. Second of all, why would you want to know? Take all the surprise out. If you could. See? Can't, but if you could. See? What I'd like to know is how to negotiate anything that happens to me in the future while maintaining a sense of well-being. That would be something to know. And that's possible to know. So we're trying to figure out how to have a controllable future. And we're doing it in the wrong ways. We're trying it in five ways. I call them the big five. This is everyone, okay? You know, for everyone. Everyone is spending a lot of time and effort trying to control the future by trying to, you know, control five areas of life. First one is money and possessions. Money and possessions. Spend a lot of time, you know, working, saving money, doing investments, and buying stuff in the hopes that we'll have a better future because of the money and because of the things. Right? Yes? Yeah. So we'll just stop with each one of these. I won't spend a whole lot of time with them because this is the wrong way to go about it. We want to know about the right way to go about it. Does money bring happiness? Yes or no? Quick. Okay, so we already admitted, we already said, better to have money than to not have money. Okay? So we don't have to go into this whole thing about how you should all be poor, because then you'd be happy. If it were that easy to make you happy by just like taking all your money away, we could all file out of here and go to the ATM machine, your ATM machine, and just put in your card, take out all your money, and then you'd be happy. So it's not in not having money. Happiness is not in not having money. But is happiness come from money? Is happiness in the money? And everyone gave the right answer. No, I know it's not the right answer. But we don't act like that, generally. Right? No, everyone knows that money doesn't buy happiness. Right? There's plenty of evidence around for that. Plenty of evidence. If money bought happiness, every rich person would be happy. Is that the case? Oh, of course not. The rich people have problems too. They are unhappy. There's a the one of the richest women in Australia is named Gina Reinhardt. She's a mining baron, you know, in the mining business. She's got billions of dollars, and her life is a train wreck. She's got all these problems with her kids. They're suing each other all the time. You know, very unhappy. Very obviously difficult life. Obviously unhappy life. And you go, yeah, yeah, well, but if I had their money, money is wasted on rich people. If I had their money, I'd be happy. Someone once said, I think I can't remember who it was right now. Someone once said that the only people who think money brings happiness are people without money. People who have money know it's not in that money, you see? They know. And so all of us should know this. Because, you know, if you did the little exercise that we assigned to you on Tuesday night, was it? And went to global rich list, one word, globalrichlist.com, and entered in your income, your average income, you will find out where you rank worldwide, and you will be astounded how high it is, you see. So in a comparative sense, we all are very rich. We all have money. And the money hasn't brought us happiness. And the same with the possessions. We have more possessions than we know what to do with. And each one, each time we buy something, new gadget, a new eye gadget, or a new pair of shoes, the average, I think, it's probably similar in Singapore, the average in America, average woman owns 25 pairs of shoes. 25 pairs of shoes. That's average. That means that there are some, you know, who's that Marcos woman? Amelia? Imelda? She had like hundreds, thousands of shoes. So you know, will the new pair of shoes bring you happiness? You know, maybe you like were in Orchard Road recently and you saw a nice, you know, fancy shoe store and you saw like a new pair of shoes. You know, you didn't have that particular style yet, or there's a color that you haven't sufficiently like stocked up on, or something like that. And you buy the shoes, and the shoes provide pleasure. Okay, they do. Buying a new pair of shoes, especially if you're into shoes, you buy a new pair of shoes and you get a little spike of pleasure. You buy a new eye product, an iPad or an iPhone or an eye. I found out recently that they are now marketing an eye potty for children who are training, toilet training. So you can put them on the potty, and in front of them is an iPad, so that they can be training to go to the potty while not being unplugged ever from the iPad. They watch all their apps on their iPad while learning how to go to the potty. So they're I everything now, right? I this, I. And do you suppose that it's an accident that they call it I? You know, I know it stands for information or something, right? But it also, of course, is the first person pronoun. I, what about me? What about me? I need that. I. So you buy a new pair of shoes, buy a new iPod or iPotty if you're a toilet training person. Maybe they'll have iPotties for grown-ups pretty soon, where, you know, we won't have to take breaks for anything. We can just go to the potty all the time, you know, be online all the time even when we're on the potty. I guess the handheld will function that way too. So these things bring us a temporary spike of pleasure. There's no doubt about that, right? Nobody's going to convince us otherwise. We know that it's fun. You know, it's nice. Nice to get a new pair of shoes. It's nice to get a raise at the job. You know, more money. It's nice. These things are temporary spikes in pleasure. But they wear out, don't they? And now quicker than ever. See, now quicker than the half-life on the things, on the gadgets, on the cars, is getting shorter and shorter and shorter before we become dissatisfied with them again, you see. And the new pair of shoes that you buy at Orchard Road, you know, tomorrow, let's say, will have the same half-life that the last pair of shoes that you bought have. They'll bring you some pleasure for a couple of weeks, maybe a couple of months. Then they'll start hurting your feet a little bit. Then you'll get sick of the color. Then they'll end up in your closet. And then they'll end up like in the back of your closet. And pretty soon they'll be just something that you'll feel, where the hell am I going to, how do I get rid of these shoes that are clogging up my closet? Isn't it? Nowadays it's incredible. You know, if you do house cleaning, you know, clean out your closets or your garage, you know, we fill these up in a matter of months again. As soon as you clean them out, then it all comes back again. Here it comes again. Okay? So we can't buy the happiness in the future through the money and the things. Okay? Happiness isn't in those things. It isn't in the money and it isn't in the things. Money doesn't bring happiness and iPods don't bring happiness. They bring a little pleasure for a while until they become a, you know, junk. They just become junk. I remember the early, some people may be even too young to remember when they first came out with MP3 players. They were like this big. Remember? They looked kind of like tanks or something. They had all of that, like, you know, protective thing around the sides and everything. And your cool new, you know, iPhone and iPad would just look like that too in 5-10 years. It just looked like some ancient stuff from the junk from the past, you know. So there's no future in these things. You see what I mean? It's not bad to have money. It's not bad to have iPhones and stuff like that. But don't put too much of your investment in them, in terms of your future happiness. They will let you down. You see? They'll let you down. So the other thing that we pursue, the second thing that we pursue is our careers and our jobs, right? And we think, well, if I got a good job and if I advanced in the corporation, in the profession, you know, then my future happiness will be assured. Okay? And many people spend their whole lives trying to do this, you know, trying to find happiness in the job, trying to find the happiness in the profession. And, you know, if you have a good job, if you have a good profession, it can bring a lot of rewarding time to you, right? You know, if you have a good one. Many people don't have good jobs. They're just, you know, kind of drones working some boring thing over and over and over again. But, you know, if you have a good job, it can be rewarding. But it will not be the be-all and the end-all when it comes to satisfaction in life. And it's good to get that clear right away. This doesn't mean, of course, that the way to satisfaction in life is to just quit your job and become unemployed. See, unemployed people don't have any kind of like better chance at being happy than employed people. It's not in the employment or the unemployment. It's not in the job or the lack of job. So here's, for those of you who, you know, and I think there are several in this room at least. I myself was one, I know, you know. Here's the best case scenario when it comes to your job, when it comes to your profession, is that after 40 years, 50 years maybe, of working at your job, the boss will come to you. This is best case scenario. The boss will come one day and say, you know, you've been here a long time. And, you know, you're getting a little older now. And, you know, we really think that you should consider retirement. And you'll say, no, I feel fine. I think we really think that you should consider retiring. And, you know, and you will be retired. They will replace you with somebody who's much better at it, according to them, much younger, better trained, new training all the time, right? You just like represent the old way. And they'll throw you a nice dinner maybe, a retirement dinner. And they'll say, oh, thank you for your 40 years of your life. Thank you very much. We'll never forget you. When I retired from my job, I retired from my job as soon as I could. You know, as soon as it was economically feasible, I retired. And after 6 months, they didn't even forward the mail to me. They forget you right away, okay? We'll never forget you. You know. Please have another steak, you know. Raise a glass to, you know, and And here's a watch. You know, do they have this tradition in Singapore where they give you a watch at retirement? In many places they do. It's a kind of a tradition to give a watch to somebody. You know why? You get your time back. Here's your time back. We've taken your whole life. We've taken the best years of your life and most of the best hours of your life. Now here's your time back. Now leave. Isn't it? Now go and retire in Malaysia or wherever people here retire to. And don't come back. Thank you very much. See? Best case scenario. Now it gets worse from there. You know, they can come someday and say, you know, clean out your desk, you're finished here. You know, before 40 years, before you get to be 60 or 70 years old. Sometimes they come with armed guards and escort you out of the building, making sure you don't steal stuff from the computer. Have you seen like that on there? Yeah. That's, you know, that can happen too. All of a sudden, there could be another economic downturn and your job is finished. You know, you become redundant and then it's gone, you see. This is a very fragile thing to be putting all your happiness in. Very fragile basket to be putting all your eggs in. Can be dropped at any time. A third one is relationships. A third sort of, you know, kind of thing that we pursue a great deal in our lives to try to assure future happiness is in relationships. There's nothing wrong with relationships, okay? If happiness were in the absence of relationships, then all lonely people would be really, really happy. Okay, so it's not in the absence of relationships, but happiness isn't in the relationships either, okay? And I'll say it like more subtly. It isn't in the way we think about the relationships. Because more often than not, here's how we think about relationships. I love you. You see, when I'm in a relationship with somebody, I love you. You make me so happy. Yeah? You ever said that to anyone? Ever thought that about anyone? That's called the first blush of love, I think. That's for about the first 2 months. It's like, you know, oh, I've met Mr. Right, Ms. Right. He makes me so happy. Everything he says, like poetry. We're soulmates. We laugh together. We cry together. We just do everything together. He makes me so happy. And then, you know, tick, 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 tick. A couple of months go by. And it's like, you know, how's it going on? It's like, makes me pretty happy. We had a couple fights, you know, had a few arguments, disagreements. But, you know, it's and then tick, 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 and time goes on. It's like, hey, how's the relationship? Yes, sir. Well, you know, sometimes it's good, sometimes, but, you know. Sometimes he makes me unhappy. Yeah. He used to make me happy all the time, but now he makes me happy only sometimes. And sometimes he makes me unhappy. Tick, 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 tick. He makes me so unhappy. Thinking that your happiness or unhappiness is someone else's, is in someone else's power, is setting them up. And is a abnegation of your responsibility for your own happiness. Okay? No one else can make you happy. Only you can make you happy. And if you think someone else can make you happy, you will also believe that they can make you unhappy. Yeah. Right? And no one else can do that either. Only you can make you unhappy or happy. So the happiness that you're looking for, that we're all looking for, is not in the relationships as we understand them. Okay? The happiness that we're looking for can be in the relationships, but not as we understand them. Not as something that someone else should do for you. See? Love isn't about what someone else can do for you. I love you, make me happy. See? That's not real love, right? That's a perversion of the understanding of love. Love means, I love you, what can I do to make you happy? And if you understand your relationships that way, then relationships can be very, very rewarding. They can bring the happiness that we're looking for in them, but not the other way around. See? Everyone get that? Because a whole lot of our culture is aligned against that understanding, you see? We have the idea that, you know, other people should make us happy or could make us happy. Do you celebrate Valentine's Day here in Singapore? What a nightmare Valentine's Day is. No, I mean, all these cards and, you know, those little candies that they give, you know. I love you. You're mine. You're right. Yeah, you're mine. I love you. You're mine. As if that's the sign of, like, real love is possessiveness. And, you know, what are you going to do for me? You're mine. Don't talk to him. I love you. Don't do things I don't want you to do because I love you. It's a complete reorientation about the relationships is necessary for them to bring the happiness. But until that reorientation, you will just be disappointed with your relationships over and over and over again. If you think that it's someone else's responsibility to make you happy, or if it's in somebody else's power to make you unhappy, those relationships will cause you nothing but pain. Suffering. Unnecessary suffering, right? Then there's entertainment. You know, nowadays we spend a lot of time just trying to keep ourselves entertained all the time, as if that was going to make us happy, you know? If, like, we were never bored, ever. We never were constantly stimulated by television, movies, you know, the internet, by constant tweeting and twittering, and what else do we do? Emailing and texting, and, you know, as if that were the way to keep, you know, to be happy. And as I mentioned a couple of nights ago, this is literally driving us crazy. As a people, we are slowly driving ourselves mad by this kind of an addiction to constant entertainment and communication. It is not the way to be happy, and it's turning out to really be biting us on the behind. You know, really turning on us. It's become an addiction for many, many people who can't go minutes even without, like, you know, checking. Did anyone tweet me? Did anyone text me? Did I get enough thumbs up on Facebook? On my last post on Facebook, right? You know, right? It's all about, they don't have a thumbs down option on Facebook. That's not accidental either, right? It's all about, like, little jolts of affirmation, you know. Did you like my cat? You know, see my cat? I put a picture of my... Yeah. Oh, only 13 thumbs up on my cat picture? That's not enough. That's not making me happy. So then, like, you know, well, what about my baby? People put your baby pictures up and hope you get more thumbs up on it, you know. There's never going to be enough thumbs up to bring you the happiness that you're hoping for in that kind of, like, culture, in that kind of culture that we live in. There's never enough tweets. There's never enough texts. There's never enough attention, you see. Never enough people, you know, paying attention to you and affirming you. Your happiness isn't in the hands of others. It cannot be put into the hands of others. And the whole thumbs-up culture is putting your happiness in the hands of others, okay? So that's the entertainment and communication, like, basket in which we're putting eggs in that can drop and continues to drop all the time. Never satisfied with that. Then the last one, the body, the physical body. If only I, you know, kept it nice and clean and, you know, and beautiful and strong and healthy, and if only I, like, you know, ran and, you know, exercised and lost 10 pounds, and, you know, then I'd be happy. If you're placing your hopes for future happiness in your physical body, you will definitely be disappointed. Definitely. Okay? I don't care how many downward facing dogs you have done. I don't care how many laps you've taken, you know, running in the morning. I don't care what kind of diet you've been on. Sooner or later, your body will let you down. It will let you down suddenly, could let you down suddenly. It's called an accident or getting sick. Or it will let you down slowly. This is called aging. And people who are getting older here know exactly what I'm talking about. Everything starts to droop. The gravity asserts its force, and everything starts to just kind of go down. And, you know, and you kind of like try to, you know, kind of keep it all together. Okay? Yes, this is an accident waiting to happen, isn't it? Anyone unclear on that? Okay? And all those hours and, you know, spend grooming it, you know. I used to keep my hair all, like, shaved and stuff, which is actually quite easy. You know, you wake up and you're there. You don't have to do it. You grow your hair out and you're just like, God, I get, you know, like a bedhead, and, you know, I got to wash it. And, you know, you have a beard and you got to comb that, and, you know. All that time wasted, really, on the body, you know. Investing too much of your self-esteem, too much of your happiness in the physical body is a losing proposition. Okay? So these are the five things that we're spending a whole lot of our lives on, hoping that this is the way to be happy in the future. Making money and buying things, spending hours and hours and hours of the best years of our life on a dead-end job. And everyone's job is a dead-end job. They all end in the same place. You got. But anyway, what was the third one? Huh? Oh, yeah, relationships. Thinking that other people can make you happy. Then the entertainment, communication, and then the body. Those are the big five, I think. If anyone can think of one that I haven't covered, please let me know, because I've been working on this for a couple of years. Those are the big five, I think, when it comes to, you know, trying to assure future happiness. So that's, and again, to reiterate, happiness isn't in the absence of those things either. It's not in those things, and it's not in the absence of those things. It's not coming from outside of ourselves. So how can we control the future? And also, of course, they're all precarious, okay? You can't control any of those things, really. You can't control your financial situation. Who knows when the next global downturn will happen? Or the next downturn in your individual, you know, life. Who knows? It's not in your control. Who knows when the job will tank? Who knows when you'll become redundant? Who knows when your health will go, or your beauty, or whatever. You can't control these things. And so trying to control our future through trying to control uncontrollable things is not the way to control the future. So what can we control? And we can control ourselves. We can control our inner life, not the externals of our life, the money, the things, the job, the body, etc. We can control the internal things. So the next section here is section 3. Future suffering can be avoided. And this is a quotation from the Yoga Sutra, the ancient text on yoga. Heyam dukkam anagatam. Heyam dukkam anagatam means that which has not come. Anagatam means hasn't come yet. That's the future. Dukkha means suffering. Heyam. It can be avoided. Future suffering can be avoided. Not by controlling events, but learning how to control your responses to events. Learning how to create the karma. Okay, so now we introduce the K word. The rest of the night is brought to you by the word karma. Controlling your karma is learning how to control your responses. And habituating yourself to responding smartly, wisely, and compassionately will make it possible for you to surf any kind of wave that comes your way in the future, by learning how to control your responses. So I'll just skip down to the next section here, because we're running out of time. I don't want to keep going on. Section 4 here is a list of the one list that's found in Buddhist literature on what's called the laws of karma, the four laws of karma. Actions are definite. This is, everyone see where I am? Page 11, I think it is. Actions are definite. They are certain to produce similar consequences. Here's just what this means, okay? If you do good, good will come to you. And if you do bad, bad will come to you. All right? So this is the sort of basic law of karma. If you are kind to others, compassionate, interested in other people's happiness and not just your own, you will have one kind of future. But if you're selfish, only caring about yourself, hurting other people in your body, in your actions, or in your speech, you will have another kind of a future. So this is the law of karma. This is the sort of fundamental law of karma. And sometimes people misunderstand this. So I thought to clarify it a little bit. So let's say that you start assiduously practicing not hurting other people. Okay? Trying not to hurt other people. Trying not to ever, for example, trying never to say harsh things to other people. Harsh speech, okay? Never yell at them, never speak unkindly to them, never try to hurt them with your speech. That's planting a good karmic seed. Yes? Now, there will be a good result from that. Okay? That's the first law of karma. Good will come from good. Does that mean that no one will ever say anything harsh to you in the future, do you think? Can you control other people? That was early on in the talk tonight, right? We established that we can't control what other people do and say. Can't control events, can't control what other people do and say. So if you're, you know, assiduously practicing, being, watching your speech, trying not to say, you know, things that hurt other people with your speech, are you going to be guaranteed that no one ever says anything unkind to you in the future? Of course not, okay? Of course not. What you are guaranteed is that you will not take it bad. That you will not interpret it as something that's going to throw you off for the rest of your day, you see? That part you can control. You can control your responses. You can learn how to control your responses. You can't control other people and other events, but you can control your responses to other events. So when somebody says, you know, something nasty to you, if you have created the karma by assiduously, you know, regularly practicing, not using your speech to harm others, you will be much more likely not to take offense at what other people say to you. Because you will have habituated your mind to not thinking nastily about other people. So that's kind of how it works. It's not going to change other people. It's not going to change events, but it's going to change you. And when you change you, you change your understanding of other people, right? Your interpretation of other people, and as well as your interpretation of events. That's the first law. Second law, there can be no effect without a cause. Okay, that's just kind of like obvious for causality, right? Nothing comes from nothing. If there's a cause, an effect will come. So that's the third one. There can be no cause without an effect. So every cause will bring about effect, and the second one is that no effect will come without a cause. So if you want good things to happen to you, plant the cause for it. And if you want bad things to come, they'll plant the cause for that, because they will. There will be an effect for every cause. And then the last one is karma grows. And this is an interesting one, I think. Because karma doesn't exist anywhere other than in your own mind. Okay? Karma isn't like stored up on Alpha Centauri somewhere, you know, on supercomputers, where Mr. Karma's up there going, you know, what did you do now? Oh, enter. What did you, oh, she said that. Enter. You know. It's just in your own mind. Okay? So you see yourself, you perceive yourself saying, doing, saying, or thinking something, and that leaves an impression on your mind, on your consciousness, on both your consciousness and your conscience. You hear the difference? your consciousness, your mind, and your conscience. And negative things weigh on your conscience. You know. And it's because we know. We know that we hurt somebody, if we did. We know that we lied. We know that we stole. And at some level, that weighs on your conscience. And the longer it's there, the more it weighs. See, that's in that sense, it grows. And it also makes an impression on your mind, both positively and negatively, see? Every time we remember it, every time we think about it, you know, even in very, very subtle subconscious ways, we invigorate it. We give it more power. It grows in us, you see? It becomes more and more part of us. And that's how karma grows, both positively and negatively. So, negatively, it's a good idea to get stuff off your conscience as quickly as possible. And we'll talk about how to do that at the last part of the class. Positively, it's a good idea to rejoice in the good that you're doing over and over and over again. To remember it, to recall it, to pat yourself on the back for it. Okay? And say, well, you know, at least I did this thing right. At least I was generous. At least I, you know, didn't lie when it was, you know, kind of like seemingly would have been easy to lie and try to get out of the situation. And pat yourself on the back for that, because that increases the karmic power of it. It makes you think differently about yourself, in other words, you see? Karma is memory. Karma is memory. We are who we think we once were. Yeah? And that, you can say, is a summation of karma. We are who we think we once were. And if we were the kind of person, if we have been the kind of person that has been nasty to other people and so forth, we will think of ourselves differently. We will think of ourselves one way. If we have been the kind of person that has tried to be kind to other people and compassionate, we will think of ourselves in another way. And that's the effect of karma, you see, on how we perceive ourselves. On self-perception. So those are the laws of karma. Here's another way of kind of summarizing them. If you want something, make sure someone else gets it first. This is called the golden rule. Maybe you've heard of it. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. The second one is the opposite of that. And don't do to other people what you don't want them to do for you. To you, right? Don't do to other people what you would not have them do to you. In other words, treat other people like you want to be treated. See, right? No one wants to be treated badly. No one wants to be treated, you know, unkindly. And everyone wants to be treated fairly and nicely. So treat other people that way. It's not that hard. It's not brain surgery, you know, rocket science to figure out what it means to be living a good karmic life. Right? Those are the only two that you really have to remember. Don't do to other people what you don't want them to do to you. Do to other people what you want other people to do to you also. Then the third one is kind of interesting. If you want to keep something, give it away. How else are you going to keep it? Except for to give it away. And you know, then we go, no, wait a minute. If I give it away, that means I don't have it. How can I keep it if I give it away? And you can't keep it in any other way than by giving it away. Okay? Everything is changing. Everything is in flux. Anything that we try to grasp onto, we will lose. See? By nature, naturally, because it's changing. So the only way to keep it is to keep it in circulation, you could say. Keep it in circulation. Give it away and it comes back. Give it away and it comes back. So that's another kind of a law of karma. If you give, you shall receive. That's what Jesus said, right? If you give, you shall receive. Here's a little bit deeper understanding of that. If you give, let's just take money, okay? Because money's kind of obvious. If you give money, it means that you have already received enough to give. Okay, sometimes they say virtue is its own reward. And in the sort of karmic principles, it's kind of built in. We wouldn't give if we didn't feel like we had enough to give. So by giving, you're reminding yourself that you've already received. You see? It's not a matter of like, you know, I'll give and so, you know, give me back. That's a very self-interested understanding of karma. We give so that we remind ourselves that we already have enough to give. Okay? And that, in that sense, virtue, karma, is its own reward. You give and you've already received. You know what I mean? All right, quickly, we'll go through the list of 10. Just so that, you know, I did my job, okay? This is the, you know, the little sort of laundry list of 10 things you can watch out for when it comes to karma. Number one, with a bullet, always, in any kind of list. Don't kill. Don't hurt. Thou shalt not kill, in the Bible it says, right? In the yoga text, ahimsa, nonviolence. Don't be a violent person if you don't want people to be violent to you. If you live nonviolently, you will see more and more nonviolence in the world. If you live violently, you will be aware of a lot of violence coming into your world. That's just kind of obvious, right? The other ones is obvious too. Don't steal. If you're constantly stealing from other people, their things, their time, and so forth, then other people won't trust you. And they'll start, like, you know, kind of nipping at your stuff too, right? It's just kind of like, in a way, much of karma is just kind of common sense. Don't sleep with people you shouldn't sleep with. These are all the negative versions of it. There's positive ones too, but I'll just do the negative ones for a while. Anyone unclear on what kind of people those are that you shouldn't be sleeping with? They are people who are involved in a committed relationship with someone else, or you're in a committed relationship with someone else. You see? Thou shalt not commit adultery. This never works out. Okay? No, I mean, you know, some of us are old enough to kind of know and maybe from some experience, okay? I'll tell you a little story quickly on this. I had a student for many, many years, very, very good student, who had heard this kind of thing over and over and over again. You know, this thou shalt not commit adultery is repeated in many of the world's traditions, okay? And when it comes to the basic moral principles of being, you know, assured of living a good life, you know? And so one day she came to me and she said, you know, I met someone. And I said, well, that sounds good. You know, oh, yes, he's so wonderful. He's like my, and then it wasn't the whole thing about my soulmate. We laugh together, we cry together, blah, blah, blah. And so that's all fine. He says, yeah, you know, there's just one downside. You see it coming? He's married. And I go, that's not good. You know, we've talked about this a few thousand times, you know. Don't commit adultery. Don't sleep with people you shouldn't be sleeping with. He says, well, yeah, but, you know, we're soulmates, blah, blah, blah. And I said, what, have you told his wife? And then, of course, said, oh, no, no, no. No, we couldn't tell his wife. We're, you know, we're Buddhists. And and we don't want to hurt people. And so, you know, it would hurt her. You know, people, when they're under the spell of a mental affliction, like lust, you know, they just rationalize anything. You just, like, you kind of go into, like, some altered state of consciousness. And it's like, no, we couldn't tell him because it would hurt him so much to know. Well, guess what happened, okay? It's predictable. These things are so predictable. So they didn't tell him. He found out, of course, you know, 6 months later. And the whole thing just blew up high as heaven, you know. Everyone was, like, hurt, you know. Everyone was damaged. So, you know, there's a lot of, if you're in the market, you know what I mean? If you're in the market for a partner, there's so many fish in the sea, okay? You don't have to go, like, picking people who are already in committed relationships with other people, you know? This idea of a soulmate, you know, he's in a committed relationship, but he's my soulmate and stuff like that. There are, how many, 7 billion people on the planet? I bet you there's more than one soulmate for you, okay? Out of seven, I mean, just the odds are huge that there's got to be more than one soulmate than the one who's already married. Don't use your words to drive a wedge between people. Don't use your words to divide people. Use your words to bring people together. Don't hurt people with your words. Use words that are kind. You know, this is going to come as no news to anyone here, that this is kind of like the way to live a good life, right? We've all heard versions of this before. Don't engage in useless speech means don't gossip. Don't gossip about other people's problems. Don't gossip about, you know, using your speech in a meaningless way. Just like talking for talking's sake, sometimes people do this, right? Don't be envious of other people's lives. Rejoice in other people's successes. You know, their success is not at your expense. It's not a zero-sum game. They didn't get the new car because you didn't get the new car. So they get the new car and, you know, well, congratulations, you got a new car. It's going to be scratched in 6 months anyway. You know, you enjoy it for the 6 months that you can. Don't be happy about other people's pain or problems. Don't take inordinate interest in other people's suffering. And we do this kind of a lot. Especially people that, you know, we don't like, especially. We're really interested in their suffering. But generally, as a culture, we're quite fascinated with the problems that other people have. It's kind of strange that the very people that we put up on a pedestal, you know, movie stars and politicians and stuff like that, we're most interested in when they fall. You know, when they're having difficulties, when Brad and Jen or whoever the hell it is, you know, have like a divorce and stuff like that. What did you hear about Brad and Jen's divorce? You know, it's a sad thing when people get divorced. It's a sad thing when people have problems. Why take pleasure in that? You know what I mean? And then the last one is don't adhere to erroneous views. And basically what that means, one of the principal things that means, is don't think that every action doesn't have a reaction. That is an erroneous view, to think that what you do or what you say or even what you think just kind of evaporates somehow and doesn't make an impression on your consciousness and your conscience. It changes you. You are creating your own future in every moment of your present. We are all creating our own future every moment in our present. What is caused in the present will have an effect in the future. And the main effect it has is on how you feel about yourself. How you feel about yourself as a person and therefore how you see the world around you. Okay? We see the world not as it is, but as we are. We see the world and other people, you could say, not as it is and not as they are, but as we are. And if we change ourselves through systematically working the karmic system, we will see a better world and we will see better people in the world because we have changed our filter. We've changed our interpretation of the world. And there's no access to the world apart from our interpretation of the world. Okay? We don't have an objective view of the world. We only have a subjective view of the world, conditioned, you could say, by our karma. So if you want to condition your interpretation, your filter of the world better, watch your karma now. You see? If you want to see the world better in the future, be careful about your karma now. And that way, you can have some security. You can have some assurance that when the future comes, regardless of what it brings, regardless of what events are, regardless of what people do and say, that you'll be in a position to interpret it in the best way, to see it in the best possible light, because you'll see yourself different. Change you, change the world. And the way to change you is to change your perception of yourself by thinking about yourself differently on the basis of your memories, of changing your memories of what kind of a person you have been, right? So you will be the kind of person that you remember yourself being now. See what I mean? Then. In the future, you will think of yourself as the kind of person that you remember yourself being now. Then? Okay? Everyone, did I confuse everyone there at the end? All right, quickly, the exercise that's connected to each one of these classes. This one is to, this is a practice that some of you have been doing for years, I think. This is called the book, keeping the book. Last night we had an exercise of keeping a gratitude journal. So you could just buy like one journal and do it with both the gratitude part and some part of the journal, and then what sometimes is called the six times a day book. Which means that you stop six times a day with your little book and check on how you've been doing. So you can do this with the 10 that we just outlined, okay? So in the morning you make a box, you make a lines that create six boxes on a page. And on the first day, on the first box you say killing, okay? Don't kill, don't hurt, don't kill. And then the next box you say, don't steal. And then the next box say, don't hurt others with your sexual activity. Like that, you know? And you go through the first six. And then, sorry. And then every 2 hours during the course of your day, you stop and you check the book, you check the box. You check the box that you're at. So at like, 8 o'clock in the morning, you'll check box one. And say, well, did I hurt any beings, you know, recently? And you put a positive sign for the way that you have protected life, the way that you have restrained yourself from hurting, and you put a negative sign for little things. You know, maybe you killed an ant that was crawling in the kitchen floor, something like that. Okay, and you put a little negative sign there, and you monitor yourself. And then 2 hours later, you go to the second box, and that is a very powerful practice. And the first thing that people say or think when they hear this for the first time is, I don't have time to do that. Did I guess right? I don't have time to do that. I'm busy. I got an important dead-end job that keeps me quite busy. And everyone has time to do this, okay? Even at the job. Here's how you can do it, okay, on the job. You have a very, very busy, stressful job. The 2 hours have gone by, you need to sort of check your diary, your moral diary. You can use some very, very powerful words of magic to find the time to spend 2 minutes checking your book and, you know, doing the plus and minus sign on each one of those 10 things. Ready? Are you interested in the powerful words of magic? Say, I have to go to the bathroom. And all of a sudden, everything stops, doesn't it? The boss doesn't say, no, you can't. No, right? They don't want any accidents. Nobody wants. We're all grown-ups here. It'd be a little embarrassing, you know. You can always go to the bathroom, right? I've done this routine for a while now. Somebody once raised their hand and said, "Well, you just said that I shouldn't lie. It was in number three there, number two, number four. It was don't lie. So what about this going to the bathroom thing?" And I said, "Well, there's always something to do in the bathroom. It's not lying." To say I have to go to the bathroom. You know, you could have a little pee-pee or poo-poo or you just wash your hands. You know, you have to wash your hands. I have to look at the mirror. Or I have to go into the stall and check my book. I have to go to the bathroom. It's not a lie. All right, so then the last thing. We've been integrating a couple of components of what makes for a proper spiritual life on a daily basis, each class. First class was get a good night's sleep every night as part of your spiritual life. Get a good night's sleep every night. Number two, wake up quietly, calmly, stay in bed for a little while, and think about two things. How awesome your life is. All the things that you have to be grateful for. All the things that are going right. Have that as one of the first things you think about in the morning. And number two is what? It's not going to last forever. Okay, and not take it for granted. Someday you will die. You don't know when. It could be today. And then you get out of bed. Yesterday we went through two other ones. Meditate. Learn how to meditate. And meditation is a very, very important skill. It's going to be more and more important in our lives. As our lives get more and more stressful, as communication gets more and more nonstop, it's going to be a survival skill to learn how to stop and get control of your mind for a little while. So, 10, 15 minutes initially, every morning. Every day do the thing that I just talked about. Checking your morality every couple of hours. Do that little book thing. Very, very powerful practice. So tonight, two more. Every day do something for someone else. As part of your spiritual life, do something selfless. Something that brings a little bit of happiness or relief of pain for someone else. And preferably anonymously. Preferably anonymously. Take the self-interest out of it, Sometimes we do things for other people and we can hardly wait to be thanked. Did you see what I did for you? Thank me. Right? So that we're doing it not for them, but for ourselves, really. For, having other people think how great we are and thanking us and all like that. So if you can do something for someone else anonymously, you get extra points. You get bonus points. Okay? And then every day do some form of physical exercise. Yoga is good. Yoga is great for this. Running. But with the right kind of attitude. It's important to get the body moving because the energy, inner energies are awakened with, a little bit of physical energy. The body and the mind are in harmony. Holistic, okay? So, especially if you've got a sit-down job, if you've got an office job or something like that, it's important to try to get some exercise every day to get the juices flowing again, but with the right attitude. Important to have the right attitude. Here's what the wrong attitude looks like. I'm going to exercise so that I'll never get sick and I'll live forever. Or I'll never get old. That's a wrong attitude. Or I'm going to go to my yoga class and observe everyone else who can't do yoga as well as I can. That's the wrong attitude. But have a good sort of healthy understanding that the mind and the body work together and do the exercise for that purpose. It is it's a vehicle. It's a vehicle, and it's very important to keep our bodies as healthy and as strong for as long as possible so that we can think straight, When your physical health goes, it's very difficult to think straight, okay? When you're sick, anybody who's been sick knows this, okay? You try meditating with a full-on cold. You got your snots coming out everywhere and you're coughing and your spiritual life depends on, the full operation of the spiritual life depends on a relatively healthy body. So important to keep that body rested, well-fed, and exercised. Yeah. All right. Questions?
Actually, less a question, more remark. I think I found number six for you. And that's the intellect. If I know everything, I can control the future. So I study about medicine and politics and about how the viruses work and all that. And I think this is a good number six.
Yeah, okay. I'll give it some thought. That is pretty good. Having been an academic for much of my life, the more you know, the more you know you don't know. So, although maybe initially, you think, well, I'll try to gain happiness through knowing everything. The more you go down that road, the more you know it's futile. You know what I mean?
They still sometimes try.
Yeah. Yeah. The great minds that I've encountered know how much they don't know. It's the smaller minds that think they know a whole lot. You know what I mean?
You may have kind of described, but you said you would come back to how you get stuff off your conscience. Down in the past.
Thank you. Thank you for reminding me.
I'd like to.
Yeah, of course, we all would like to do that. All right, here it is. You can remember it in terms of the four R's. Four R's. The first one is reflection. Reflection. Thinking about, reflecting on what kind of self-image you want to have. You know, thinking about the person that you're looking at in the mirror. What's that Michael Jackson song? I'm looking at the man in the mirror. Yeah. So you look at the man or the woman in the mirror and say, you know, what kind of a person do I want to be? And hopefully you come to the conclusion that I don't want to be the kind of person that has this kind of thing on my conscience. I don't want to think about myself as the kind of person who has done these kinds of nasty things in the past. So the second one is regret. And I talked about regret last night, wasn't it? Regret is different from guilt. Guilt doesn't do anybody any good. It's just beating yourself up. It's just kind of self-centered in a way. But regret, good, healthy regret means I know I shouldn't have done that, and I regret doing it. That in some of the Buddhist texts, they say it's like the regret is what you would feel. This is kind of like how to distinguish it from guilt. Regret is what you would feel if, you know, I took a sip of this world's greatest chai. And someone said, oh, there was cyanide in that. There was poison in that. You know, you would regret drinking the tea, right? You wouldn't say, oh, what a bad person I am. I feel so guilty. You see? Guilt is completely inappropriate. But regret, yeah. Okay, so, you know, you have the kind of regret, good, healthy regret of knowing that the kinds of things that are weighing on your conscience are harming you. And you regret it. You have good, healthy regret. Number three is restraint. Of saying, I will restrain myself. Kind of regret feeds into restraint very quickly. Regret and restraint are very close. I regret it, and so I will try not to do it again. And you make a very strong resolution, as strong as you can, to restrain yourself from doing what it is that you're regretting in the future. And then the last one is some kind of recompense. Recompense. Restoration, restitution, you know, something that functions as a kind of an opposite of the thing that you're regretting. So let's say you harmed somebody else. You consciously go out of your way to help someone. And then in your mind, you kind of dedicate it to the restoration of the thing, of the harming that you did in the past. You see what I mean? And you do that as far as long, you know, you take them one at a time, of course, one, you know, bad deed of the past, you know, at a time, and do those four things over and over and over again until you feel like you've done it enough to clean it from your conscience. And only you will know that when that time has come. And then I always like to put a fifth one in, and that is to, you know, after you've done it enough so that you feel like you really have cleansed yourself, to give yourself absolution, like the priests do, and to say, okay, you know, I have sincerely and systematically done these kinds of practices, these kind of four R's, reflection, regret, restraint, and recompense, restoration. I've done this systematically and conscientiously for a while, for this number of weeks or whatever it is, days, weeks, months, and now I'm done. Now it's off my conscience. And only you know that. Only you know when that will be. And that's how you change it. That's how you get it off your conscience. It's a very effective way. A couple of written questions and we can all go home. I have a wound in my body that bleeds every day. What could have caused this? What suggestions do you have for me to remove this pain? Had seen doctors, had surgeries, and it is a chronic condition for many years. The doctors will tell you what could have caused this, in a way, right? They'll tell you that there were certain physical, causes and conditions that came together to bring an ailment like this. The question always is, well, why me? Why did I have that happen to me? And that's a much harder question to answer. And I personally wouldn't even try, you know. Nobody in the Buddhist texts, they say that karma, the exact workings of karma, lie at the level of what's called very hidden. There's obvious, you know, some things are obvious. The fact that, you know, I have glasses in my hand is obvious. Then there are hidden. The level is hidden. The fact that these glasses are changing nanosecond by nanosecond, right? They're changing. It doesn't look that way, right? It's a little hidden. It doesn't look like they're changing nanosecond by nanosecond. But then they say the exact workings of karma is very hidden, which means that only an enlightened being knows the exact workings of karma. So somebody like me couldn't tell you like what the karma was that brought you the physical condition, any particular or any other particular thing, you see? The exact workings of karma are very, very hidden. What is helpful, I think, since we can't know exactly why events happen to us, you know, the way they do, is to number one, realize that such events happen to everyone, number one, okay? So you have a particular kind of physical condition, you know, particular kind, but everyone's got physical problems. And if you don't have a physical problem now, well, you will. And if you don't have a physical problem, you have a mental problem. Everyone's got problems, okay? No, it's part of our suffering to think I've been singled out somehow. You know, this is just so unfair. I have this terrible condition, and I've just been picked on by Mr. Karma, you know, or by God, or whoever it is that you're blaming, you see. Everyone suffers. And that helps, I think, a little bit to kind of put things in perspective, to recognize it's not just you, you see. And then you can also, and I'll talk more about this tomorrow night, actually. You can also say, and now I know, since, you know, before I had this condition I didn't know, now I know what it feels like to have a physical problem, like other people have always had. Other people have always had physical problems. Other people have physical problems. Now I have one too, and now I can gain some compassion, real compassion, for this kind of suffering that other people have gone through. And then you're on your way to changing it, you see? Then you're on your way from changing it from a problem into something that you can use productively, spiritually. Okay? You can't just make it go away, or you can't, like, you know, magic won't work here, but you can reinterpret it. Okay? You can't change events, you can't change other people, but you can always reinterpret it in a positive manner so that it's not just some negative thing. Use it to, and that's a very, very, very powerful positive way to think about a problem, any kind of problem, physical or otherwise, is to use it as a way to generate more compassion for the suffering of others, because now you're feeling it firsthand, and you know what it feels like, and it doesn't feel good. And other people are feeling just like you. You know, other people who have problems are feeling the pain just like you are. Where does conscience come from? Is it created by karma? If one has less conscience, does it mean that karma will grow slower? Conscience and karma are kind of the same thing. It's recollection. It's memory. It's how we think about ourselves in relation to how we think about our past. And we do not think about ourselves in any other way than through memory. You see? I challenged people a couple of nights ago to think, who would you be if you had no memory? You see, in what sense would you be anyone if you didn't have memories? So karma and conscience and consciousness creates our sense of self. That is our sense of self. So it's not that we have memories, or we have a conscience, or we have consciousness. We are that, you see. We are our memories. We are our conscience. Or you could say we are our karma. Our self-understanding, our understanding of who we are, is our karma. Okay? And that can change. We are who we think we once were. We think about ourselves in the present on the basis of the memories that we have about the past. And those can be conscious memories, those can be subconscious memories, or those can be unconscious memories. Okay? It doesn't have to be always conscious all the time. So in that, that's karma. That's what karma is. Karma is nothing other than that. Okay? So you can change your memories by changing your past, and change your sense of self. That changes your sense of identity. And you can change, you can gift yourself with new memories in the future by paying attention to your actions in the present and change your sense of self in the future that way. See what I mean? That was tonight's class. Changing the past was last night's class. Changing your sense of self by changing your understanding of your past was last night's class. And changing your sense of self by gifting yourself with new memories in the future on the basis of your actions in the present. It was tonight's class. And that's how you change. That's the only way to change. That's the only way to improve yourself. And that's the way also to change your perception of the world around you. To change. The events are unpredictable. The events are uncontrollable, future events. The people and the things that people do and say, unpredictable, uncontrollable. But your self-perception and the perception that you have of the events and the people in your world in the future is controllable. And it's in control. You're in control of it now. You're in control of your future now. You see? On the basis of what you do, say, and think. Now, you will think about yourself differently in the future. All right. If one has less conscience, does it mean that karma will grow slower? Karma, I'm not sure like how you measure conscience, like how you get more or less conscience. Karma gets stronger the more you think about it. The effect of memory, I'll put it like this, okay? The effect of memories on your present is stronger on the basis of how much you think about it. So if you're reviewing your a particular memory over and over and over again, it obviously has a deeper impression on your consciousness now, right? So if you have something big on your conscience, you are at some level thinking about it a lot. You know, it's nagging at you. You're reviewing it over and over and over again, and that changes you. That makes that karma more powerful. And similarly with a good thing, if you've done something that especially that was hard, you know, something good, something beneficial, something selfless, especially when it was hard for you to do it. Well, you remember that like in a more powerful way too. You know what I mean? You remember, well, you know, this person really, really provoked me, and I really wanted to get angry and yell back and do this and do that, but I restrained myself. You know, you remember that differently than if it were easy, You see? If it were easy, it didn't make that big of an impression. So in that sense, karma has different kinds of strengths on the basis of how much of an impression it's made on you and continues to make on you in terms of your memory. I think it's really interesting to think about karma as memory, don't you? Yeah. What else would it be besides memory, you know? Past is past. Past is gone. The only time that exists is in the present. And so karma has to be some part of our present all the time. Our past karma has to be some part of our present all the time. And the thing that, you know, in the Buddhist text, I'll just end it this way. In the Buddhist text, there's big debates on where is karma stored, you know? You do something, you create a karmic seed, where does it kept, you know? And the most persuasive answer to where karma is stored is in what they call the simple sense of me, the simple sense of yourself. In other words, your self-conception, yourself, how you think about yourself is your karma. How you think about yourself is where karma is stored. And of course that changes and fluctuates and so forth. Right? Karma changes and fluctuates also. With the changing, as you change your sense of self, it means that your karma is shifting. You see? That's what karma is. Karma is identity. Karma is your sense of identity. And for those, you know, the real Buddha heads in the room, that's the only self you have. Anatman. No self. The only self you have is a self-conception. The only self you have is an idea of the self. And the idea of the self that we have is our karma. Okay? Yeah. Well, we ended with a big bang. Thanks very much for coming to me.
Thank you very much. Thank you also to the people.